the things that I used to do. Lord, I won't do no more. The things that I used to do. Lord, I won't do no more. Search all night for you, baby. Lord, in my search would always end in vain. I would search all night for you, baby. Lord, in my search would always end in vain. All alone, darling, that you was hit out with your other man.
From school funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues that impact Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. That's Things I Used to Do by Guitar Slim. It went number one on this day in 1954. We're about to have another conversation with Dr. Kay Whitehead, who joins us frequently here, of course, a professor in the Department of Communications at Loyola University of Maryland. And she's now founding executive director of the Emily Frances Davis Center, named after the woman that she wrote the book about, for education, research, and culture, and has been assigned to do a series of op-eds in the Baltimore Sun during this month of February. And we're going to talk about those a little bit more. And Kay, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, as always.
So what is this series you're doing for the Sun? Let's start with that, because one happened last week. One's coming up on Sunday.
Yes. So I approached the Baltimore Sun op-ed director, Tricia Bishop. I tend to do op-eds throughout the year. If something happens within the Black community or something that impacts the Black community, I always like to respond to it. Op-eds are a great way to reach people outside of academia, people that might not read my book. Although I think everyone should read it.
Of course they should. Of course they should.
They might not pick up a journal article, but they will grab their cup of hot coffee and grab their Baltimore Sun and read through the newspapers. So the op-ed columns are a great way to reach those people. So I asked Tricia if they would be interested in having me host a series of op-eds just for the month of February, one per week to air on Sundays, that examine and explore the state of the African-American community. It's hard to do that in just four op-eds, but I thought it'd be interesting to at least try.
What are the themes? I mean, we know last week you did this kind of overarching look, which we can talk about in a minute, about in terms of the effect of African-Americans on the United States and the history of the United States on Black folks and racism and the power of that in a historical sense coming up today. And then this piece coming out this week is about gender, right?
Yes. As I looked at the themes that I wanted to address this month, I knew I needed a foundational piece. And so the first one that came out this past Sunday looked at the state of Black America going back to 1619 and coming forward from enslavement to freedom. The second one, which is coming out in just a few days, looks at President Obama's policies towards women and gender. And it was dictated by my time working on the White House Black History Month panel, which was on this past Wednesday. The third in the series will look at poverty in the Black community. Everyone's been talking about Ta-Nehisi Coates' piece on reparations, and I want to talk about that in terms of what is happening within the Black community and what does it mean to be impoverished and to be a person of color in America. And the fourth piece in the series, the last one, will take up this mantle and this question around Black lives mattering. What are some of the things that I think that the Black community should begin to focus on? We're now in the 150th year where we celebrate the 13th Amendment. We're celebrating the Voting Rights Act. We're going to begin to talk about the assassination of Malcolm X, that there are a lot of big issues that are happening this year, from the release of Selma and talking about movements. Well, what should we focus our attention on? Because we can't cover everything and everybody can't do everything. So I'm going to attempt to address some of the big issues I think we should focus on as we move forward through 2015.
So just quickly, so what was it you did at the White House?
So President Obama hosts an annual Black History Month panel. He is not the first president to do that. Presidents have been doing that ever since Gerald Ford said that we should recognize February as Black History Month. The president has hosted three of them. I have been blessed to have been invited to all three. So in 2013, we examined From Emancipation to Freedom. We really looked at the full story of Black Americans in this country and talked about it. He invites four scholars from around the country, and it is co-hosted by the Association for the Study of African-American Life and History, ASALA, Carter G. Woodson's organization. And, of course, they set the theme for Black History Month. Last year, we looked at Blacks in the armed services, and we started with the Revolutionary War up until today. What have Black people, men and women, contributed to this country through their time in the service? What we looked at this time, which I thought was very interesting, is we did a review of President Obama's policies. The four experts covered education, health care, mass incarceration, and I focused on women and gender.
And what did you say?
Well, I was prepared, as I was going into this, to say that the administration is not doing enough work. That's what I was prepared to say, because I'm aware of the policies towards my brother's keeper. And as the mother of African-American boys, this makes sense to me, that we have a safeguard in place to help to disrupt the classroom-to-prison pipeline, to help catch young boys so that we can raise their graduation rates, particularly among boys of color. We know that boys of color tend to drop out of high school at a higher rate than other boys, and they tend to be on this path towards incarceration. So I am a huge supporter of my brother's keeper. At the same time, I'm aware of the African American Policy Forum's work with Black Girls Matter, you know, asking the White House to take a look at their initiative and redesign it to include the work towards young Black girls, because research is showing us that Black girls are graduating at a much lower rate than white girls, that they are six times more likely to be suspended, that they are overpunished and they're overpoliced, and they're suspended for things like being disobedient or being defiant, or if their hair is done the wrong way or if they're not wearing the correct clothes. So I knew that there was work on the ground to force the administration to look at this. So I did not expect to find much. I know about the Lilly Ledbetter Act. I mean, who doesn't have 2009
right
around, you know, pay wage disparities? I thought that was it. I thought that was all the administration had done. And I realized I was wrong, that this administration has made incredible strides on behalf of women and girls, everything from expanding health care for females in the military and for female veterans to having more small business loans, which typically go to women and women of color, to having culturally responsive programs for girls of color in school, to working on behalf of girls of color who are in the foster care system, since we have approximately 400,000 kids in foster care, and over half of them are female, and a large percentage of them are females of color. The work that he has done to raise the minimum wage for federal workers to $10.10, and then challenging Congress to do the same for all states across the board. And even though Congress hasn't taken up the charge, 13 states, including Washington, D.C., have taken up the charge to raise the minimum wage. My concern is that there's still work to be done, and I talked about that as well. We know that the 1963 Equal Pay Act, and that's the act that was supposed to guarantee the same wages for men and women in the same types of jobs, we know that's not being actively applied. The latest figures show that for every $1 that a full-time working white male makes, white women make 77 cents, and Black women are making 64 cents, and Latina women are making 56 cents on a dollar. So there's still work to be done. This administration seems to be making a push in the right direction.
You said seems?
Well, because on the surface, it doesn't really apply to all women. On the surface, you think that he's really just dealing with a small percentage of women. But as you begin to delve deeper, the work that he's doing to make sure that the federal government is addressing the needs of women, that is ultimately important. Mm-hmm. Having someone who's now in charge of violence against women and creating the White House Council of Women and Girls, you know, Valerie Jarrett is in charge of that. Making sure that the needs of women and girls, that's something that's a part of U.S. diplomacy around the world. So I say seems because on the outside, you don't know exactly what's happening until you delve deeper and you see the work that the administration is doing and actively trying to help women and girls have a voice. The other area, which I think is absolutely exciting, is in the area of STEM, trying to encourage more girls to focus on STEM. STEM is a game changer. I'm not a STEM person. I'm a humanities person. But we have found that in the area of STEM, women who are focused in that area make 30% higher wages than women in the humanities. Believe me, that greatly disturbed me. But race and class and gender, it doesn't seem to come into play as much as it does in STEM as, say, in other areas, in history or in philosophy, where these things really matter. But in STEM, if you know about the science and the math, you can really advance in that field. And President Obama's administration has been putting money towards being mentors for young girls, putting programs in the school through the Race to the Top program that focus on STEM. Can we catch girls early enough and get them excited about STEM to make some differences along the road, to happily help them when they're beginning to choose a major in college? They choose a STEM field over a humanities field. And I know that sounds horrible coming from a humanities person. I mean, I love my field, but I also want to see women across the board in all the different fields. And that there is new territory for women.
So I'm curious why you chose that as a theme to put in the series of conversations this month, which was focusing on, for you, focusing on the state of the black world in America.
I thought it was interesting, and I really wrestled with it, whether or not to step out in a sense of a series that just began and talk about President Obama's policies. But I know that during Black History Month, that was the theme and the topic for the Black History Month panel, because you had black scholars really reviewing these programs with an eye towards what's happening in our own community. So when I looked at his policies of women and gender, I was very concerned and focused on seeing what is happening for women and girls of color. Is there work being done? And I chose to include that in the series because I think that is it's a huge issue in the black community, because in the black community, we have more single-headed households by women. And if they're making only 77 cents, then it is shortchanging families and women in our community. We have a lower graduation rate from high school and college in white women. What is being done to be a safeguard for that? These are the issues that I wanted to have addressed, and those are the issues that I saw when I went and looked at his policies and I looked at what is happening around the country, and I felt that people needed to know that.
I was thinking, as you're speaking about that in the series you're doing, what raced in my head was a lot of things. One of them was that that the development of racism in the world, this as a codification of race to justify slavery, which built the American capitalist and the world capitalist system, some people could argue that racism itself is maybe 400 or 500 years old, just from the enslavement of African people and as the underpinning of American society, which I'll come to in a minute. But you could also argue that misogyny,
yes,
is the underpinning of human civilization.
Yes.
In terms of its depth. Right?
And how much we see all those tangled weaves as we go forward. Why are women underpaid? Why are they undervalued? These are not new issues that we're struggling with. Why do we not have equal pay for women? Why do we see kind of the breakdown of what people call the family? And family has different meanings. We're not talking about the 1950s traditional family.
Right.
I'm talking about the ability to bring in incomes. Why are women sometimes kept out of what we call the American dream, whatever you perceive that to be? But for some, myself included, part of that American dream is being able to provide for your family, to make sure there's food on the table, to get back and forth to a job, hopefully somewhere near where you live, so you're not walking and riding and catching buses hours away to get to where you can have employment. So how do we address that? I mean, misogyny does not change because we're changing the Equal Pay Act. I mean, it doesn't change because Obama is extending these policies around, you know, the response to rape that's happening to women, and the numbers have been rising both, you know, in marriages and relationships, and now, of course, in high school, we're starting to address that. But I think it's a start. I think one of the ways that we can begin to hopefully turn around the lives of women who are economically suffering is to pay them more money, is to look to fix what is broken. And the fact that the Equal Pay Act is not being actively applied, that is something that is broken. So how do we fix it? Perhaps one way to fix it is let's raise the minimum wage. Now, this is kind of the catch-22, because if you raise the minimum wage and you raise everything else, then you're still in this cycle of poverty. Because is $10.10 enough to work you out of poverty if the cost of everything goes up? Right. Well, that was one of the problems of the system, that we tend to try to help people get out of poverty. But once you raise the cost of goods and services, I cannot move. It is a cycle and a circle that seems to be never ending. So even though I don't think that President Obama is going to be able to solve this deep-rooted problem, some of the work that's being done, I think, is moving us in the right direction. I do want to note, and someone said this jokingly yesterday, that I am not an employee of the White House. I am not. I am deeply, I want to be clear, I am deeply critical of the White House, as I think we should all be. Mm-hmm. We should all be deeply critical of the people that we put into office. I mean, that to me is the heart of democracy. I vote you in, therefore I can begin to review what you're doing. And even if I didn't vote for you in this country, you're still my president. And I have the right to begin to look at your policies. I have the right to be critical. And I have the right to ask for more, particularly if I don't think my needs are being met. So I am not an employee, but I am able to recognize when work is being done. And I think that's something that I thought about when I began to put part two of this series together.
So what do you there's so many things to ask you here, and we can do it over the course of weeks, and we'll have to shove it all now in this period of time that we're together. But I, you know, I was thinking about what I just said earlier about misogyny being even deeper than racism in our world and going across all societies. When you talked about reparations, a little bit ago, referring to the piece you're going to write in this series and attaching it to me, to the both the first and second thing you wrote for The Sun, you used the word, you said you used impoverishment and reparations and together. And some people look at reparations as something deeper than just a question of money and poverty, that it has to do with just the entire nature of the society, and in some ways how the reason Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a piece now that has generated a conversation that even he didn't expect would generate out of the Atlantic. That's the power of print, because print can explode conversations. People forget print's still here, and it can explode conversations across the universe, not just YouTube and digital world. But anyway, so that it has to do with everything that's in the society, the way we think, why America is so terrified of – parts of America are so terrified of the browning of this nation and of Europe. It has to do with – I mean, it runs deep in terms of people's thinking and not being aware that it even exists. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's more than impoverishment, isn't it?
It is. I want to kind of add to that this conversation about reparations, the one that we're having now, almost as a response to Coates' piece, is, as you know, because of your work as an activist, not a new conversation. I mean, they've been talking about reparations right. in the Black communities from as far back as I can remember. My father was very actively involved in the civil rights movement, and he talked about reparations in the 70s. I mean, they've developed councils on reparations. So even though Ta-Nehisi Coates, as this part of, you know, Schubert's unfinished symphony around race relations, he's kind of being introduced into this, the topic he's talking about is not new. For some people, they thought we were just starting to talk about reparations. This is an old conversation. Reparations is not just about money. Some people think that it's just writing a check to the descendants of enslaved Americans. And in so many cases, how do you prove that? I mean, given the lack of records, how do you actually prove who gets the money? And is that really enough? If I just give you $2,000, is that enough to change this country and change the way you are seen and treated in this country? And we know that it is not. It's just what you said. The foundation of this country is built on the backs of African American people and keeping them impoverished and keeping them in this working class.
So,
and not, I'm sorry, not working class, this worker class, which is very different than a working class.
Because I think that the idea of reparations is when the word is heard, it has depth of understanding in the black community especially, but it causes ripples of consternation, confusion, and objection to the rest of the country.
I think that's because, and this is really just my opinion and my understanding of it in the conversations I've had with people from all different races and ethnicities and genders, people don't quite understand what reparations is. Is it just, like I said before, writing a check? In Ta-Nehisi Coates' piece, which is absolutely brilliant.
Great piece, yep.
Absolutely brilliant. But he's talking about this change in consciousness that needs to take place in the hearts and minds of everybody, because we're all a product of this system. I mean, we've all been centralized a certain way to see people of color in very distinct ways. It's not just something that's white on black. It happens within the black community as well. And so when he talks about this movement of consciousness, that reparations is the first step towards starting this conversation, even he is the first to admit he's not sure exactly what it's going to look like. And whether or not it's even possible, that his idea behind writing, and people can, of course, you know, find more about this when they look online and read it for themselves, was to get this conversation going again with this new generation, that we are trying to find ways to right the wrongs. I don't know what that means. Are we finding, what wrongs are we talking about? Are we just talking about enslavement? Are we talking about being impoverished? Are we talking about misogyny? Like, which of the wrongs are we talking about? And because it took so long for them to become entrenched in our system, there is no simple solution. Reparations means different things to different people, and it's very complicated. I haven't even defined what reparations means to me, and I'm going to wrestle with that in my third piece, because my family, we're one of the few families in South Carolina, we actually received our 40 acres and our mule and the $50. So since we received that, if reparations are given out, am I excluded from that?
Well, the question is even whether reparations has to do with the check going to individuals,
that's
or whether
the
something
thing.
Much deeper and much broader.
Because there are all kinds of microaggressions that I'm a part of. My family was actively, you know, a part of being, they were actively involved in fighting against Jim Crow, which means that's what my father grew up under. So what does that mean? I mean, we still have the 40 acres. It's air property. It's all swampland. Like, nobody can live on it. But one of my students said to me, well, you know, Dr. Whitehead, you got everything. I'm like, but what does everything mean? Because if everything means just
40 acres of swampland,
it's 40 acres of swampland. So we can't even live. But I do always go down there and take a look at it and take my kids there and pick the cotton. So you can't do anything with it. But if that is everything, like if that's really what the heart of this is about, giving somebody some money, then I think we're very, very far from understanding what needs to happen in this system so that people can be equal.
Yeah, because it's huge. I mean, everything from the argument where prisons should be, should they be abolished, should be something different, institution be in this place, deinstitutionalizing. There's so many pieces to
this. So many moving pieces, right?
So last week we had your opening salvo. Mm-hmm. right? In the Sun last Sunday. This week is on gender and race. The following week is
poverty. We're looking at reparations as a question.
And the fourth week again.
The fourth week is looking at the Black Lives Matter movement. What should we focus on now?
So I would hope would engender some serious conversation in the world here and in this community as they read these pieces. And I would look forward to kind of continuing this either the week after next when they all come out and kind of look at them and as a whole and bring some people in to kind of wrestle and talk about them and debate and argue what they all mean. And I think this is good. I'm glad you're doing this.
Thank you very much.
It's great. Congratulations on being called to the White House for, what is it, 3 years in a row?
3 years in a row. I'm very excited about that. Now, has my life changed? That's another conversation, right? But
the White House changed your life, did it?
I'm enjoying the conversation. I do want to add that I was listening to an interview with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and she was asked, they said, you're not at the Supreme Court. Is one-third female.
Right.
Is that enough?
Right.
And she said, it will be enough when they're nine.
I love that.
So when people are asking me, you know, haven't we talked about black history enough? It will be enough when Black history gets folded back into American history and students are learning this all the way along. It will be enough when we no longer have to challenge the system to be included. It will be enough when we find out ways for people to be equal and have equal access to goods and services. And in that vein, I don't think enough will ever be enough because these are very difficult topics to wrestle with and apply.
If we had a moment in our future when Americans realize, the majority of Americans realize, that there would be no American history without Black history. Black history is American history. It's intertwined. You can't separate them apart as if they're separate and equal.
Right.
Separate but equal, right?
Right.
Kay Whitehead, thanks so much. Always good to see you.
Always. Thank you very much.
So we will be linking to her articles, to her op-eds on our website, estanashow.org. And they'll be coming out for the next several Sundays, this Sunday and two Sundays after, her op-ed pieces on race. And the first one was From Slavery, Enslavement to Freedom. And we'll be linking to that so you can see what she's written before in case you missed it. And Kay Whitehead, of course, is an assistant professor in the Department of Communications and Africana Studies as well. Mm-hmm. And has founded this new center called the Emily Frances Davis Center for Education, Research, and Culture based on the book she did, The Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, which is a marvelous publication in its own right. And Kay, thank you once again.
Thank you very much.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern and Dan History research producer is Sienna Greaves. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. On our way out of here, we're hearing Blue Monday by New Order. Peter Hook of New Order was born on this day in 1956. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.